at the end of the show, I smashed the six TVs and I came off the stage in Boston, and immediately in front of me was Kurt Cobain saying, "I love the way you smash the televisions, man," you know.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Vintage Rock Pod, the podcast series that proudly claims that my music is better than yours. This is the podcast series where we interview rock stars from the classic golden age of rock, from the 60s, the 70s and the 80s, and we hear all about their wonderful stories. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now, we've got a great interview this episode with a man from one of the leading punk bands of the late 70s. They had some great hits and have been held up as inventors of pop punk. Their catchy hooks and subject matter certainly differentiated them from the crowd back then, and do so now, to be honest, as well. There's some great stories in there about Sex Pistols and Nirvana, among others, and it's coming up very, very soon. Quick heads up, though, no Maudy this week. I think he's away cleaning demons from swimming pools or whatever it is these celeb rockers in LA get up to. But we'll have him back on next week's show, that's for sure. A quick shout-out as well to some listeners as well this week. Had some great feedback from last week's interview with Scorpions frontman Klaus Meine. That was a great interview. Very, very funny he was as well. If you've not had a chance to give that a listen yet, definitely recommend you spin back to episode 8 and do so. It's brilliant. A lot of discussion around what the band's best album took place on Vintage Rock Pod's Facebook page. Richard Ruth, David Whitty and Parker, Mike Weil, Ronnie Melton, among others, all getting involved on there. Corey Burmeister, Adam Fiona Ingleby and Susie Q for all their shares on Facebook. That's much appreciated. Thank you to My Rock Mixtapes on Instagram and Twitter for pushing the podcast too. And also to Dire Straits blog. They turned my interview with the band's bassist John Ilsley from episode 2 into an article on their website, and they pushed it around places as well, which was very nice. Got a few hits on the interview on the YouTube as well. So thank you very much to all those guys and to everybody else for interacting this week. It's always very much appreciated. And thanks to listeners in Bulgaria, Denmark and Romania for stretching the podcast reach to 27 different countries now. Absolutely incredible. I thank you all. If you've not done so yet, hit like and follow on our social media accounts. Search for Vintage Rock Pod on all the usual places, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Just come along and say hello. I'd love to chat with you. Right, so let's kick off this episode and start where we always do, finding out what classic rock stars are hitting the headlines this week. And we do so with friend of the show, author and journalist Tim Peacock. So let's find out how he's getting on.
I'm all right, thanks, Paul. I'm working away. Yeah, doing all right.
Keep him busy. That's what we like to see. Keep him busy. The question on everyone's lips, though, Tim, is did you get a chance to listen to the new AC/DC album? I know you've been a busy boy, but did you get a chance to listen?
Only once. But I can't really pick out any specific tracks that I like because it was only a very, very quick listen. But it sounded good. It sounded consistent. And, yeah, it is. Angus was saying in another interview, he was saying, well, it's the AC/DC sound. It's what everyone wants. We've not deviated. Fair play to him. It sounds good. I thought it was rocking, certainly. It is what I think people would want from them. You made this point last week, Paul, and I do think so. I don't think they can go far wrong with that. I don't really think we want them to make like a dubstep album or something at this stage now, really. So, you know.
No psychedelic now. No,
nothing too much like that. So, but I will check it out again more next week. Yeah.
Good stuff. So what have you got lined up for us this week in the news then, Tim?
Right. Okay. Let's start with Frank Zappa this week. I would actually say I'm not a huge expert on Zappa by any means, but I think it's probably fair to say he's probably one of the biggest cult artists there's ever been, really. I mean, long after his death, attracts, you know, huge interest in people. And as you've probably seen, there's a documentary about Zappa which is out. It's just called simply Zappa. It's been directed by a guy called Alex Winter, and it's now available on demand from Magnolia Pictures in the US. I know a certain amount about the background to Zappa with, you know, working with U-Discover, and I do know the estate are very hands-on with everything that happens in relation to them, but apparently this film, they're promising unfettered access. I mean, there's interviews with Zappa's widow, Gail, and various of his collaborators, including the great Steve Vai. And they've been advertising it's like being a big weekend. They've been advertising it as Franksgiving instead of Thanksgiving in the US. So, and there's going to be a box set coming out as well next year. So, yeah, that looks like an interesting one. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, I'm a bit like you. I was never a huge fan of Frank Zappa. I remember at university, I had a friend who was massive into him. So when we'd be in the common room, whatever, he'd be blaring out there. And I always thought he was very eclectic. That's probably the simplest way of putting it, to be honest with you, isn't it?
So yeah, he's one of those people. I think he certainly polarizes opinion, but I think he's one of those people, I suppose, a sort of slightly Marmite type aspect to him, if you like. But it's one of those people, I think, if you really love him, you really, really love him. I mean, I'm thinking of people, I know people from right across the spectrum. I mean, Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, his home studio is called Joe's Garage for a reason in Dublin. I'm quite good friends with the legendary punk band the Roots or Roots DC as they are now, and I remember I was talking to Segs and Dave from the band about the making of their first classic album The Crack with Malcolm Owen, the one they made with their original singer, and they were actually saying to me at the time, we wanted it, you know, we were listening to a lot of Zappa and we wanted that quality when we were making it. I'm thinking, wow, you know, this is one of the classic London punk bands and they're referencing Zappa. I mean, I know they do listen to a lot of stuff, but he really has that across the board appeal to people. So I think it's certainly going to be interesting. Also, Paul, about this one, apparently the film Zappa has been, it's a crowdfunding thing originally. It started, there was a Kickstarter campaign. It began in 2016, and apparently it's become the highest funded documentary in the crowdfunding site's history. So there is a trailer on YouTube. So if you just type in Zappa film on YouTube, you can have a gander at it anyway. So sounds interesting. Yeah, the box set that's coming with, there's a load of rare stuff in a box set which is coming out. That's out in May, but I think there's actually a pre-order for that as well. If you can have a look at on Amazon and see there's more information. So that's our cult figure to start off with today.
Absolutely. So from cult figure to where do we go next then, Tim?
Well, we go to I'd say a household name really next, I would say, Paul. Paul McCartney, of course, who has another new album coming out shortly.
Oh yeah, I've heard of him, I think.
Yeah, he might get somewhere one of these days. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks to Kanye West, of course, let's not forget. Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. Yes, the legendary Beatle is supposed to be sitting down with the actor Idris Elba shortly, and they're doing they're going to record a 60-minute special. This is for the BBC. I'm not sure what date it's going out, so it doesn't have a broadcast date at the time of talking now, anyway. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be called, wait for it, Idris Elba meets Paul McCartney. But anyway, it's supposed to be...
I bet they thought long and hard about that one.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right. It's supposed to be broadcast this month, December. I don't have a date, it'll be closer to Christmas. It's going to be going out on BBC Radio 2 and BBC Sounds, and... they are promising that the discussion will span the entirety of Paul's career. So I guess we're talking early days of the Beatles right through to his new album, which is coming out.
And did you say 60 minutes? Because that's an awful lot to get into 60 minutes, isn't it?
I'm thinking that myself. Yeah, it seems a little bit optimistic, but I don't know. That's what they're talking about. I imagine that they will be talking about McCartney's new album. He's just been doing like a lockdown album, which is called McCartney 3.
I think everyone's doing something during lockdown, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. Well, apparently this is one he's played more or less all the instruments on it, all from what I gather, but he's done a couple of these albums before McCartney and McCartney 2. You know, again, so you can follow the thread with it. But I think that very first one, I think McCartney won the first one. It was almost like a kind of precursor to like the lo-fi recording that people do now, and that, as in that he played everything on it. So he's carried on with that tradition. So that's out on December the 11th. So I guess the documentary thing will probably, the broadcast will probably follow that. So one to look out for.
So what have you got next for us then, Tim?
And finally tonight, Paul, more classic rock. Well, we talked about the Beatles. So the famous rivals at one time, even though they were very good friends, the Rolling Stones. Did you see that they'd launched a new memorabilia store recently in London? Yes. Have you seen that at all?
Yeah, Carnaby 9 or something. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. It's called RS Number 9, and it is in London's Carnaby Street. They opened the shop physically in September, and one of my colleagues from YouDiscover, who actually knows the Stones a little bit, he's already been there, and he says it is very, very good, although he does say that some of the prices are, well, certainly high-end, shall we say. Now, I've only had a quick look at it, so I don't know. You know, he was saying that even, like, the mugs are quite expensive and so forth, so I don't know, but it's all officially sanctioned merchandise. But now that they've just launched an online version of it, there's an e-version of it you can check out now. And apparently this promises a fully immersive 360-degree virtual shopping experience. So it sounds quite interesting anyway.
Okay, so if you're big fans of the Stones and you want some official merch and you can't get down to London because of lockdown and all these sorts of restrictions, then best thing to do is check out their virtual online store.
Yeah, and apparently they've all kinds of stuff in there, Paul. There's lots of memorabilia. There's a lot of vinyl for sale, but also limited edition accessories and giftware. And the other thing that they promise in there, there's a bespoke T-shirt customization station. So I don't know if that means you can actually go in and just start from scratch, a bit like Build-A-Bear or something. You have your shirt or something, and you can, you can have whatever design you want on it. But that's one of the things they're offering. So, but I've not obviously not tried it myself, and I don't know anyone personally who's actually tried that service out, but that's what they're offering anyway. So, yeah.
So many things came to my mind when you said about the shirt customization. I thought the first thing was the football shirts, you know, when you have your names printed on the back. And then the second one was, can I have my face on instead of Mick? Ronnie next to me, my face over Mick's, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, sounds like a cool idea, doesn't it? I wonder if you can actually. I'd rather like that. I'd like to be next to Charlie, I think, if it was for me. Charlie Watts is a big fan. I'm a big fan of him. So, you know, so was it? I think Keith himself said to be the Rolling Stones, you need to have Charlie and four other people. So, I mean, there you go. Can't say fair.
Yeah. absolutely. No, absolutely fantastic, Tim. Thank you so much for bringing us the latest news as you do here. And where can we catch you if we want to read your work?
You can catch me on youdiscovermusic.com and you can catch me in Record Collector.
So when Tim mentioned it there at the time, Alex Winter, the name rung a bell with me. He's directing the Zappa documentary. Now, Alex Winter, I've just looked, he's well known to people, probably better known to people, actually, as Bill from Bill and Ted from the movies. So there you go. Thanks, as always, to Tim for coming on and sharing us the headlines from This Week in Rock. Right, it's time to hear from our rock star interview now, and it's the first foray of ours into the classic punk world, really. This guy was the guitarist in one of the big early bands of the UK punk movement, one of the first big punk bands to come from the north and actually make it big. He formed a cracking songwriting partnership with Pete Shelley, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago. Sit back and enjoy this week's interview. I'm delighted to be joined on the phone today by a guitarist who's been there, seen it and done it over the last 44 years. Welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, Steve Diggle from Buzzcocks. Hi, Steve.
Hi, nice to be here. Yeah.
Good stuff. Now, 44 years, I mean, for a band, a punk band, you know what I mean, to have lasted so long. I mean, a lot of them crashed and burned and quickly fizzled out, but to be around for so long, I mean, what do you put that down to? What do you put your longevity down to?
Well, you know, in one way, it seems to have gone so quick. You know, if you look at it in terms of albums and stuff, I mean, we have made quite a few albums, but looking at it like that, you think, well, we haven't done that much over the years, but we have done a lot. We've toured all those years. We've toured the world for years, and you just sort of get in the swing of things, really. You know, I enjoy on the road, and I enjoy making records. You know, it was what I was born to do, really, you know. You had a little dream when you was like 16 or 17, that you might join a band or get a band together. And then it's become the biggest dream possible, you know. So I spent all my life doing it. And, you know, it's been amazing. I get off on the crowds. I mean, we've done thousands of shows all around the world, you know, Brazil, Australia, UK, you know, England, of course, everywhere. So that keeps you alive and going, really, you know. And the fans have been, like, stuck with us through, you know, all the years. And, the thing about the Buzzcocks, I mean, we were a powerful act live. It was really rocking, you know.
Yeah.
You never had to go to a Buzzcocks gig and ask anyone to clap their hands or stand on the seat or something. It was just like they was kind of telling you, you know.
Yeah. And you see the videos and you see yourselves. I mean, you're always dripping with sweat. There's so much energy, not just from the crowd, but from yourselves as well.
Well, absolutely, yeah. You know, you're kind of feeding back. It's like a cybernetic two-way feedback, yeah. You're getting the vibes from the crowd. You're giving the vibes. And in the middle, that's where you kind of meet, where everything comes alive. Because we know we've got like an hour and a half or whatever to generate this thing. And, you know, the nature of Buzzcocks songs, which is usually fast and up-tempo, generates that. That's where you see God, the devil, and yourself and everything else in the middle bit, you know. But that gives you the excitement. And, you know, you go away feeling alive. You know, the crowd feel alive and... you know, it's inspiring for the crowd and for us, you know. So that's the lifeblood of doing it, really, you know. So it's 44 years, but it's never been a problem, you know. It's what I signed up to do, really, you know.
Brilliant.
Although I didn't know that at a time where you don't know where it's going to take. You think, well, if you get a few shows, a few gigs, see where it goes from there. Because I never really planned anything as such, but... all of a sudden, you know, I mean, things just took off. And we had, you know, some great songs, as you know. So, I mean, you know, we did a single. It was like, wow, this is the Buzzcocks on the map. So we started in, you know, well, we brought the Sex Pistols to Manchester, so we were really at the beginning of punk.
I was going to say, yeah, your first show was on the bill with the Sex Pistols, wasn't it, in Manchester?
Yeah, well, we brought them there because I think it was Howard, when everything, the band, he'd saw them in a, like, little Chelsea club. It was unknown, really. And he said, we'll put a poster up and in Manchester, and we ended up opening up for them, and all the journalists came down to see the Sex Pistols. There was a surprise that there was a band from Manchester there, you know.
Yeah.
Like, we came on and blasted out 20 minutes. So, you know, they were surprised, but that kind of put us on the map because they reviewed that. You know, they all thought it was starting in London, but we kind of had the same idea and feelings in Manchester, you know. And that kind of put Manchester on the map,
yeah.
And then the provinces on the map, really. Because, you know, people in Sheffield and Scotland and all other places thought, you know, we can start a punk band in our own town. So it was very inspirational, really, in that way. Because it's like, well, if the Buzzcocks can do it in Manchester without going to London at the time, you know, it was like, well, we could do it. When we went on those early tours, you know, every town came alive, you know. All those 70s discos were taken over and suddenly become like punk venues, you know. I mean, we didn't know, we kind of played, you know, we was on the White Riot Tour and all that, bigger venues, but you'd go to these little clubs after, and go, this was run down, and all of a sudden, everybody's come alive because they've taken over the place and made it a punk venue. So, very exciting times, you know. And
you said it was really exciting times. I mean, what was it like amongst the punk bands at the time then? I mean, obviously, you did bits with the Sex Pistols. Was the camaraderie about what you were doing at the time, or was the rivalry, or was it somewhere in between?
Oh, no, we was kind of like mates, you know. I mean, the Sex Pistols loved us, you know. They loved what we were doing because it wasn't like them, you know what I mean? Them and the Clash as well, you know. The Clash loved us too, you know. But so we all became like the school of 76 really started all that, you know. And so, you know, I knew the Clash well and the Pistols well and all that stuff. And also the Jam and the Damned, you know. That was the nucleus. Punk rock in 76 and 77, all the other ones came later, you know.
Yeah.
But that was our school, and if I ever run into any of those, we all kind of know where we started from, you know. So there is that camaraderie there. There wasn't any rivalry there with all that then, you know. But what happened from there then, it was like suddenly you had to start making records, and so each band got their own identity, you know, because everybody was just, oh, you're a punk, aren't you, and all that kind of stuff. And then nobody knew really what it was or what it was supposed to be doing. And then, you know, the Clash put singles out, we put singles out, and each band had their own identity, you know.
Brilliant. And you signed with United Artists, and as fate would have it, it was on the day that Elvis died. But from that point on, you guys just kind of worked non-stop, didn't you? You put out some like three albums in just under 2 years, didn't you? And you toured, like you said, the UK and Europe and America as well. I mean, how was that at the time? It must have been exhausting.
Oh, it was, but it was 1 minute you was doing nothing, and by the age of 20, you know, suddenly, like you say, it all took off, and it was like, we'd go in a rehearsal room and, you know, Pete'd have some songs and I'd have some songs, and we go, oh, it goes like this, and we've got to be at the pub half past five. They open, you know, and it's closing the afternoon. And so we'd bang these songs out. But the band was so tight and good. It was like, you sound the band your song. And it was like, okay, it goes a bit like this. And we had them sorted out. You know, we didn't spend days sweating about this stuff. But you realise the magic and the chemistry of the band at the time could pop these songs away really easy, you know. And when you're young, you know, and you have that, it's kind of like this magical self-belief somehow. But, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, we'll bang the hit single out and then we'll be in the pub at 5:30, kind of attitude, you know. Didn't worry about it too much. But we knew what we had, you know. There was a lot of off the ball with who Peter was and who I was, you know. You'd kind of do that bit at home. So when you came in with your chords and the chorus and some words you were working on, it was like, you've done a lot of the internal work at home, or, you know, hanging around with yourself. So there was all that. But those songs came together, and like you say, with we'd put singles out, and then they wouldn't be on the albums, most of them. So we'd do the albums as well. So it was very prolific in those times. And then we'd go off on a 32-date tour. You know, we used to do about 82 dates a year and more, as well as being in the studio. So I can't remember being at home, really.
And is that one of the things that contributed to the first breakup of the band then?
I think it was in the end, yeah. I mean, it's inevitable, really. What happens is, you know, a party can't last forever. And from touring Britain and Europe, suddenly, you know, you're going to America and places like that. And you don't really break America. America breaks you, you know.
Yeah.
But we had some wild tours there. I mean, it was full on rock and roll, you know. And so it takes us a long while to get around the world in a way, doing these tours. And then you'd like I say, you know, be like, well, when let's do the next single or the next album. So yeah, it took a lot of your time, and we was together a lot of the time. And there were some pretty wild times there. So eventually you're going to kind of burn out, really. And that's kind of what happened after, I think it was 5 years or something like mm-hmm. that. 5 years of intensity, you know. But you wouldn't change it for the world, you know what I mean? It was just like the painter Turner, he tied himself to the mast and went out to feel the elements in the sea. And that's what I thought it was, felt like, you know, bring it all on, you know.
Yeah.
So It, when you get an opportunity, you've just got to take it and realise, you know, we just took it all in our stride in a way, but you've got to have a lot. It's one thing learning an instrument, but you've got to have a lot of stamina and strength to deal with all the other stuff, you know.
So you guys got back together after a few years apart, and then you went from strength to strength. You carried on recording albums and touring, and you toured with some huge acts. I mean, you were on one of the last tours with Nirvana, weren't you, at the stage in 94?
Yeah, we did the last tour with them. I mean, we were in America, and we're playing in Boston. We were doing like a 40-day tour of America. It was like, we had an album called TTT, Trade Test Transmission Tour. So we had all these televisions behind. I used to smash 6 televisions every night, did it all around Britain, Europe, and all around America. So at the end of the show, I smashed the 6 TVs, and I came off the stage in Boston, and immediately in front of me was Kurt Cobain saying, "I love the way you smash the televisions, man," you know. So I told him there was an art to it, because I nearly died of electric shock on one show. And he said he's only smashed one television. I said, "You've not lived, man. I'll show you the art of doing it." So it implodes and the smoke comes out. So we did that tour in the end. Sam shot himself at the end. But we got well with all Nirvana, you know, with Dave and Pat Smear and Chris Novoselic. You know, we had a great time with them, you know, in and out of each other's dressing rooms and stuff. So, that was they was big fans of the band as well, you know.
Fantastic.
But, you know, Buzzcocks had that very unique sound, and, you know, we was very distinctive, really.
Yeah, you were almost, well, not almost, you were. Your songs were a lot more intellectual in subject matter and lyrics and things like that than your stereotypical what you class as a punk band, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and we had, like, a few discordant chords because we was, like, into crowd rock and different things like that, you know. We was into experimental stuff, you know. When I was 16, I'd go out on a Saturday night. My mother, she'd be hoovering up the next day outside my bedroom, and I'd have the hangover. So I recorded her once on my 1970s big stereo and played the Hoover, the vacuum cleaner, back at her, you know, 100 watts. And I realised, wow, that's white noise, you know, and you can record a Hoover. Which I did on my solo. I was telling this story in the studio when I did my solo on Inner Space Times a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And so we had a Hoover on the track.
Good memories.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all comes around again, if you see what I mean.
Good
and
stuff.
I read a quote from Johnny Marr saying, on Autonomy, that riff, down, he said, when I heard that, he said that I knew that was the new riff of Manchester, you know, a modernistic, you know, call with the new sound, you know, which I thought, oh, that's a good compliment. I never
it certainly is.
Like that, but it's kind of, you know, for that time as well, it was kind of, you know, different and futuristic and being experimental, you know.
Definitely. Yeah. Now, just looking at now then, you've released a fantastic box set. I mean, 6 CDs in there. It's got 137 tracks. There's 83 previously unreleased ones on there as well. It's called Late for the Train, Live and in Session. It's got an absolute ton of brilliant material, live stuff going from many different years and stages, and it is absolutely tremendous. Now, you've been heavily involved in this, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, we were speaking about what we're doing in lockdown, and that was one of the things we was kind of talking to Cherry Red Records about, this stuff. They was asking if we got anything. And we did a box set of the last four albums called Sell You Everything. And then, of course, it was like, well, we found some demos we put on there. Then it was like, oh, well, there's these radio stations and these proper 24-track live recordings of mm-hmm. shows and stuff. So during the lockdown, because, you know, we can't do anything, it was like, well, let's put all that together, because, you know, well, a lot of fans were asking for that. You know, is there anything in the can? We get asked that a lot. So, yeah, we've been trolling through all that stuff and come up with this thing of all like the radio sessions, yep. and the live gigs, Late for the Train, yeah. So that's kind of like the companion now to like the last four or five albums we had as the box set, Sell You Everything. So there's these two things, which for a Buzzcocks fan, you've got a lot of material there, yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal.
That's interesting things, yeah.
And then you were chatting as well, like you said, just before the start there, that... like a lot of musicians during lockdown, it's been difficult because you can't get out on the road and play for the fans, which is what you love to do. But on the other hand, we're going to have an amazing 2021 because the amount of bands that are going to come out with new music is going to be phenomenal. And you said you've not recorded, but you've written enough great material for two albums. So you're going to have to kind of hone that into one now, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, I'll have enough for other things. I'm willing to put some singles out and then albums, you know, singles perhaps not on the album and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But yeah, I'm going to sort of start recording that in February. We did have a single out, Got to Get Better, and Destination Zero. Yeah. I like the B-side better, even our rock book. But what I want to do with the next batch of singles I do is make deliberate B-sides, if you like. Because remember growing up, you'd hear things on jukebox, the B-side was always a bit weird. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So rather than try and make two hit singles or something, you know, like A-side ones, I want to do some weird B-sides, you know what I mean? So you've got like a classic A-side and then something weird on the B-side, you know.
Bit of experimenting.
A bit more experimental and a bit weird. It's like, well, that's definitely the B-side, you know. But getting to something that way with it, you know, bring someone else to the table rather than like just trying to write some, you know, commercial hit or something, you know.
Absolutely.
Which we never did anyway. We always just sat down and did what we did. They only came in because people... voted with the feet. Yeah. But yeah, so we're doing that. We had the Got to Get Better single out. And then people loved it, you know, they were buying it on the road and in the shops and downloading it and everything. And then, of course, the COVID came in. So got a lot of stuff. And like you say, see, every band in the world can't wait to get out there and play their new material and get touring again, you know.
Yeah. It'd be an absolute pleasure to see you back on the road and listen to your new material. Now, Steve, thank you so much for joining us on Vintage Rock Pod. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Absolute pleasure. Hopefully see you next year.
The wonderful Steve Diggle from Buzzcocks there. Remember, you can also catch the interview over on our YouTube channel. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod and you'll get it on there, along with all the other interviews and stuff like that we've done too. Now, with such a long history, it's never easy trying to pick a top five with some of these acts on these series, but here goes. Here's the top five Buzzcocks songs according to Vintage Rock Pod. At five is a track released in 1980 from the album A Different Kind of Tension. It's catchy and hooky and has a really bouncy bass line. And number five is I Believe. At number four is a sing-along staple that the Buzzcocks were brilliant at. This came from their first album, Another Music in a Different Kitchen, and was released as a single in 1978. At number four is I Don't Mind. At three is the first track the band released to the world, and very controversial at the time too. Didn't get a lot of airplay on radio, as you probably understand. Singer Pete Shelley in a later interview said it's the only song he listens to and shudders. But to be fair, it's a great song, and it sits at number three for me. It's Orgasm Addict. Second on our list is the band's first track to break the top 40, reaching number 37 in 1978. Didn't originally appear on a studio album, but later showed up on repressings of Another Music in a Different Kitchen. It's another of those irrepressibly catchy upbeat punk numbers that even appeared on one of the Guitar Hero video games. At number two is What Do I Get? And at number one is perhaps the obvious choice, but it is a masterpiece of the generation, from the album Love Bites. NME named it the best song of 1978, and a cover of the track featuring legends like Roger Daltrey, Robert Plant, David Gilmour and Elton John, among others, was released in 2005 as a tribute to the great John Peel. It topped out at number 12 in the UK charts too. The number one Buzzcocks song, according to Vintage Rock Pod, is the wonderful Ever Fallen In Love With Someone You Shouldn't Have. There you go, a great list of tracks there from a wonderful band. Check them out if you're not too familiar. As always, let me know your thoughts on that selection. Do you agree or disagree with that list? I'd love to hear from you. Get in touch on all the social media channels. Search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube and let me know. There you go, another brilliant episode of Classic Rock Musings. Thank you for listening. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast series wherever you're listening to this show. Give us a review and a rating too as well. That all helps. Tell your friends and spread the word about the podcast. Little heads up about what's coming up in the next episode then. We're changing direction. We're going to speak to an incredible songwriter who's been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame over in America. Two of his songs appear on the biggest selling album in American history. And as you'd expect, he's got some great stories about working with one of the biggest bands of all time. Until episode 10 then, take it easy and keep listening to your rock music. And if you come across anyone who isn't a fan, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.